Hey, on Younger Women, Chelsea Giesling of Good Girl Comeback joins us on a Monday. Plus, our scripture verse of the week and the latest happenings at EWTN with our very own Doug Keck.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this hour is someone and you may have heard before on Church and Culture, Pastor John Berenson. Is retired from the Lutheran ministry. He was a friend of mine back when he was a fellow graduate student at Emory University. He was working for a PhD in theology. I was doing a PhD in philosophy. He's a graduate of Yale Divinity School in St. Olaf. He proudly was a member of the choir there. He is an author. He published in 2008 a book from Roman and Littlefield entitled Cross-Shaped Leadership on the Rough and Tumble of Parish Practice, and it was very well received if you read the reviews on Amazon. And John is someone who is a regular columnist now for The Christian Review, a online magazine that I myself recently founded some months ago. And his columns there have been quite well received, including the latest one, which is the subject of this particular conversation. John Berenson, welcome to Church and Culture once again.
Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure.
Now, your column really caught my attention because you began by talking about your relationship with your father-in-law, a very close relationship, and the fact that you read books together, and one book you read together was by a very well-known Anglican archbishop and biblical scholar, theologian named N.T. Wright. He's a man I actually know and once upon a time sponsored at a conference on biblical theology in New York. Very, very, very nice man, but more importantly, a really first-class theologian. And the book that you talked about in your column, book entitled Surprised by Hope, Rethinking Heaven, the Resurrection, and the Mission of the Church, which was published, I believe, in 2008 or 9, the same year you published your book. And what really caught my attention about your column was your insistence on, and you agreeing with N.T. Wright, on the physicality, the materiality of post-death experience of heaven and the meaning of on earth as it shall be in heaven. I was surprised by sort of, you might say, the literalness that you interpreted that passage in Scripture and all the other passages that talk about what happens to a individual person after death. He doesn't just go into heaven and hang out as a spirit. Just what was it, John, that you were trying to tell us in that column?
From my over 40 years as a pastor and experiencing with, obviously, families at the time of death, the experiences of death in my own family, in my own life, plus I would certainly say aging, that goes into the mix. And being required as a joyful responsibility to preach on these subjects, whether at those special occasions, life passages, or the inevitable parts of the church year where, you know, you are really confronted with texts about death. And also, especially Easter. I think early on as a pastor, I struggled with Easter because it was so much easier to preach Lent because it was easier to talk about our sorrows, you know. It was easier to talk about our hurts and to make it relatable. But as our preaching instructor always said in seminary, the hardest things to preach on are like the incarnation, Christmas, and Easter, because what do you say when you can't lure people in by some, say, sadness? And
in other words, it loses, does it kind of lose the hook, the dramatic effect of,
yeah,
well, I'm a big sinner and this is what you can do about it?
Right. Or you become a kind of, as I've said in some other writings of mine, which I think is our tendency in North America, kind of an exhibitionist about your hardships and your failures and your sins. And so, you know, it's sort of like, you know, look at me. And but also I think I just, it was a combination of pastoral, personal, and I think reading down through the years and scholarly materials, I recall quite vividly in the seminary a book that was very popular in the 1950s and 60s and has since kind of gone the way of the dodo bird, but I loved it. It was called, it was by a German Bible scholar, Oscar Kuhlmann, who was very famous in the 50s and 60s. And he wrote this very pioneering book called Immortality or Resurrection? And he was part of what was called the biblical theology movement. And although the thesis is somewhat strained at this time, it still was very powerful to a young clergyman to say the proclamation of the church is not immortality of the soul as it is in, say, philosophical traditions, you know, the disembodied soul with some sort of cinder of physicality left behind. But the true proclamation of the church and the scriptures is the resurrection of the body, the resurrection of the dead. And while the thesis was somewhat simplistic, it really took hold of a lot of us. And I think I began to revisit it several years ago under the impress of pastoral ministry and personal experience that the philosophical traditions, but also pop culture, regarding, I'm at Aunt Marge's funeral, and she's just in the next room hanging out, you know, and she's going to be this ghostly, immaterial being, and that's going to be her, quote, final resting place, as they say at the funerals. I began to realize that that's not what either the scriptures or the traditions of our community teach, really, that our popular conceptions are a kind of a goulash of just that, literature, culture, but not actually the biblical traditions of Judaism and Christianity. I also felt it made my preaching restrictive when I was trying to console people. How do you tell people they're going to be reunited with their loved ones in an appropriate way that you're comfortable with? So all of those things, personal...
Let me read one line from N.T. Wright's book, which I think could be the launching pad for your explanation of just how it is we're going to meet our friends and family, dogs and cats or whatever, in the next life. And N.T. Wright says this: Jesus' resurrection is the beginning of God's new project, not to snatch people away from earth to heaven,
right,
but to colonize earth with,
right,
the life of heaven. Now that's a pretty powerful statement, and one that I think might surprise a lot of very, very well-educated Christians.
Well, you know, there's a combination there in Wright, and he, pardon the pun, rightly puts us back into the texts themselves. There's a powerful combination working in his book, I think, and also in our theology, of the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father, on earth as it is in heaven. Wright really makes a great deal out of that and saying that's a framing text to frame all of our other discussions about afterlife, about heaven, resurrection, hell, rapture, and he goes through all these things. But I think his paradigm is the Our Father, plus at the very end of the Bible in Revelation, where there's a, quote, new heaven and a new earth,
right,
and that the old heaven and the old earth don't disintegrate, but they are reconciled and reunited. It's literally Easter for the world, or Easter for the cosmos. That's a much different notion than what you'll get, say, in popular preaching from some fundamentalist circles, that we're all going to go up into the sky, the bad people are going to be left behind, and they're going to be burned up into a cinder while the rest of us go kumbaya as kind of Casper the Friendly Ghost figures to all eternity. That is simply not in any of the texts. But it's important to kind of have a grasp of that, especially if you're counseling and consoling people who want to talk seriously about not only their own death and their faith, but also that of their loved ones. And I think until I actually started to revisit this stuff maybe 10, 12 years ago, I was uncomfortable preaching, say, at Easter or at funerals in any way that I was trying to avoid something. I just felt that I had to own some of this. And yes, then there's the stuff in St. Paul. He strains to talk about, for him, immortality is not immaterial.
Yeah, he talked about spiritual bodies, soma pneumaticon.
Right, and it's just sort of like you sit there, you're dumbstruck, as well as he is, and you don't know what to say because he's obviously on the limits of language and the limits of human conception to talk about, well, what is a spiritual body? You know,
it was very different from the Hellenistic philosophy that he was brought up in.
Right. Also, the other consequence of this, and I think one of the reasons N.T. Wright's book is very important, because I know he's interested in things like environmental concerns. If all of this is so, if the heart of our tradition is the reconciliation of heaven on earth, and therefore earth is going to become what it should have been in the beginning, but was scarred by human sin, et cetera, and brokenness, then that means that what we do in this life is not a matter of indifference. Our concern for the earth, our concern for material things, for stewardship, for caring for things, wouldn't make any sense if we're all just going to burn up a cinder and go into the sky.
Yeah, let me read another passage from N.T. Wright, which basically expands on what you're saying. He says, the point of the resurrection is that the present bodily life is not valueless just because it will die. What you do with your body in the present matters because God has a great future in store for you. What you do in the present by painting, preaching, singing, sewing, praying, teaching, building hospitals, digging wells, campaigning for justice, writing poems, caring for the needy, loving your neighbor as yourself, will last into God's future.
Yeah. There's someone, it's attributed to more than one theologian, the statement, matter matters to God. It's attributed to more than one, and it's really kind of stark. Let me tell you a story from my parish ministry. I don't know if you recall a few years ago when everyone thought the world would end because of the Aztec calendar. When was that?
Right.
2010, 2012. Well, I was in my parish, and we had a group of new members joining our church. And this one gentleman spoke up, and he was talking to the class, and he said, well, you know, I have a sister who's so convinced of this and so in this. And he really kind of let his hair down, and he said that she's taken her kids out of school. She's decided she's not going to pay her taxes, not go to the doctor. Nothing really matters because we're all, as we say, flying the coop here. That's the consequence of a practical consequence in an extreme form of this kind of thinking.
Sort of waiting for Armageddon, waiting for the end times.
Yeah, a form of escapism so I can get out of this mess I'm in, and therefore I have no more responsibility. So the consequence of that kind of thinking is a lack of responsibility, whereas resurrection thinking and Easter thinking and heaven and earth coming together puts back on us in this life responsibility for one another, the neighbor, life, the earth. We can't just say, well, it's all going up in smoke, so who cares? So, all of a sudden I have to go back to work on Monday. I have to take my kids to school. I should go to the dentist once in a while. I should. I should.
That's my weak point.
Well, yes. But if nothing matters, because we're all just these disembodied Casper the Friendly Ghosts, excuse me, none of this would matter. So, also, this is a matter of preaching ethics.
There was a heresy in the early church called docetism, which was exactly what you're talking about, the assumption that Jesus didn't have a real body.
Right. He was like this fellow floating 3 feet off the ground, wink, wink, nod, nod, with a kind of a costume, I'm using caricature, and just so he could relate to us and relate to us poor person.
He just appeared to be a body.
He appeared to be human, but it was just kind of a show put on for our weakness. Well, that was declared a heresy because it contradicted the incarnation. And it contradicted, I guess, the Council of Chalcedon, although I wasn't there, although some of my friends were. But but I mean, so that's that. One of the things that Luther said, pardon me, on your Catholic network, in his commentary on John 1, excuse me, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, Luther said, how can anything be more consoling than for God to come so deep in the flesh? And
he was a good Augustinian, and that was echoing one of the main messages of St. Augustine.
Yeah, God deep in the flesh. And I also thought of this before we went on the air deal. I remember reading, right about the time I was reading the Wright book, something from St. Augustine that one of your, could have been one of your popes quoted, or one of your official documents, where Augustine actually starts to say, well, at the end of the world, sure, we're all going to be kind of dust and ashes. How is God going to put it back together? And in a very almost childlike way, Augustine will actually speculate about, well, what's he going to do with my fingernails? What's he going to do with my knuckles? What's he going to do? How can he figure out my eye going together with this eye? But he does it, not in a sarcastic way, but in a very profound way, where he's trying to confront the materiality of our next life, but he reaches the limits of language and the limits of thought. But it's very beautiful to hear him struggle with it.
Well, actually, I thought of you just over the weekend. I was reading a book review journal that reviews academic books. And just in the last month or so, Oxford University Press published a book entitled The Materialism of St. Paul.
Yes, it's okay.
I mean, and I thought it was a very strange title, given that materialism is usually something that we associate with Marxism.
Yeah.
That is materialism philosophically. And then when I read the review, I immediately recognized that it was the same kind of theological argument or perspective that you had written about in your column for the Christian Review, and that you had found explained so well in T. Wright, the Anglican theologian. But is materialism the right word here, John?
Well, man, that's a loaded word, and the way you're using it is obviously used in a sociopolitical way. But that doesn't sound. That's the title the book was given.
Yeah.
I wonder if that title wasn't given just to grab people's attention, because
doesn't
sound like the kind of word that you would give if you were trying to accurately portray what you're saying is. I don't know.
You're not saying materialism, because materialism is a denial of the other side. It's a denial of the spirit, of spirituality, of the supernatural.
Yeah. At the same time, of course, we get stuck in this thinking where the spiritual, I can only see this academically, I'll even see it in parish life where people will say, here's another example from the world of the practical world. Well, Pastor, we don't want you talking about money and possessions and things like that. It's not spiritual. Leave us to do, quote, the business of the church. Now, that's a kind of a common parish.
You actually hear that? As a pastor?
Oh, yeah. And I once said to a fellow, 20 years ago, when he complained that, how can you talk about things like money in the church? It's not, quote, spiritual. And I said to him, well, over half of the parables of Jesus of Nazareth are about a person and their possessions. What are you going to do with that? And he said, I don't want to hear it.
He was at least being honest with you.
Yeah, and never mind Jesus, you know. So you look at that and you say, one of the things that's made me think when I work in parishes, when I'm sitting with the parish council, or as we call it, the church council, I know you ladies and gentlemen think that some of your work doesn't go appreciated because it's not real glamorous and sexy the way the choir is or this or that. But believe me, if it weren't for you slaving away with these books and this and that, not only your people, but you would not enjoy the benefits of the fellowship and the hearing of the word and the celebrating of the sacraments. You need to connect the dots there, folks. And the more mature people eventually do. So this also has loosened me. Young clergy, I find, I don't know how this is with young priests, but younger or newer clergy are so heck-bent on avoiding the dirty work of an embodied institution.
You got to spell that one out a little bit.
I'll hear pastors say, it doesn't belong on my desk to do this stuff. I only do spiritual things. I've heard that, and so it's sort of below my dignity to answer the door when the photocopy man comes to the door of the church. That's below my pay grade, you know. I hear that kind of thing as a way of escaping responsibility and reality. So for me, this even has those kinds of practical consequences in community life. I don't get to sit in my I want to sit in my study and pray in solitude. Yeah, Henry Nouwen taught us that in seminary. But it shouldn't be beneath me to go answer the door for the mailman.
And it shouldn't be over the head or irrelevant to your parishioner for you to address issues of money, economics, business, politics, etc.
And for ultimately for me, this all goes back to the preaching and proclamation on our ultimate hope, which is the resurrection of the dead and the resurrection of this dead world.
Well, go back. I want you to, okay, now start this over by talking. You use the phrase resurrection thinking, which you earlier contrasted in the Kuhlman book with the philosophical notion of immortality. So it seems to me there's a very important distinction between resurrection thinking and the kind of thinking that came down from the Greeks and others who, you know, to their credit, tried to conceive of an immaterial world, an immaterial reality. But this resurrection thinking is not devoid of materiality.
No. Resurrection thinking is precisely meant to, use the word, integrate what we would call the physical and the non-physical in our cultural and Greek terms. You know, Plato was the one who talked about the immortal soul and the mortal body. And, you know, the soul just...
Which we call dualism.
Right, dualism. And frankly, most popular thinking, even my own sometimes, coming from hymns and attending public services, is dualistic. It is, I've been laid to my final rest. I've gone off to heaven forever and ever, world without end, amen. As if that were the end of things, as Wright rightly points out. Yes, that's part of the biblical witness, being held in the presence of God consciously. But we're still yearning for a final chapter. And that chapter is the reuniting of heaven and earth. And therefore, my body and the things of the earth and the things of the body are not destined to be discarded. They're destined to be transformed.
Well, let's look at four moments in sort of salvation history as examples of what you're talking about. Creation itself was God, the immaterial being, acting for whatever reason to create this material world. And then you have the incarnation, which is the unifying of of spirit and matter. Then you have the resurrection, correct? Which is itself an announcement of the reunification of body and soul, or world and heaven.
It's really reunification or reconciliation, because along with it, that goes the notion of forgiveness, mercy, of healing. So, yes, it's a reunification, but not in some just sort of metaphysical sense or some chemical sense, you know, of chemicals reuniting, but literally God making peace with this world by coming down and agreeing to finally meet, as it says in Revelation, to make God's home on earth.
You know, the extreme political movements of the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, particularly communism, has always been accused of trying to create heaven on earth. They all believed in so-called the perfectibility of man. Some of them, of course, were considered themselves Christians, taking on earth as is in heaven literally. What's the difference between them, and of course, these are men and women who caused tremendous destruction and death, and what the scripture is telling us?
Well, now you come, of course, to the central concept, the big S word, sin and salvation. Which are very falling deaf ears a lot. But the central proclamation is that on earth as it is in heaven is an overcoming and a reconciliation of the brokenness and sinfulness of the world as it is. So the world as it is, the reason for God's heaven coming down to earth is the world is not as it should be. The world as it is not as it should be because of what we have done. And therefore, God, that's the same reason for the incarnation, God steps in. It's as if God's saying, okay, not working out with you people. I'm going to have to intervene. And there's this intervention, which is both judgment and mercy, and it's I find it very emotional. So,
but what is it that Wright means when he says to colonize earth with the life of heaven?
Well, yeah, I know that word falls a little bit oddly on me. But what I know he's trying to say is that the values of heaven, the values of the kingdom, if you look at, for instance, if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, the kingdom of heaven is like this. The kingdom of heaven is like that. Jesus comes to proclaim the kingdom. John the Baptist says, I come to proclaim the kingdom, which is now about not a place in the sky, but about an order of things, a new order of things, a new set of values that contradicts the values of this world. And but the world resists. I mean, you get the principalities and powers in other parts of the New Testament. So really what you have is the world just saying, I'm not going to do it your way, God. And God says, I guess I'm going to have to step in. And God stepping in causes the drama of the crucifixion, the passion, everything else, of the world basically saying, no thanks, you know. So the heaven on earth is, in spite of, you know, is very different here. This is a new heaven, a new earth, transformed, that is beyond the abilities of humans. To
it's beyond our notion of the perfectibility of man.
Yeah. God's saying, you guys just can't hack it. It's an intervention. It's an intervention from outside the world, if you want to put it that way, put it in almost rehab terms. That's what it is.
Tough love.
Dr. Phil says to us, yeah, it's Dr. Phil saying to people, how's that working for you? Well, the whole drama of the Bible is God saying, how's that working for you? And God saying, rolling up his sleeves, and God saying, I guess I'm going to have to step in here and straighten this thing out.
Okay, I'm talking with Pastor John Berenson about the meaning of on earth as it is in heaven. Please join us for the rest of this conversation after this short break.
The Holy Trinity Apostolate Lenten Symposium is Saturday, March 14th, and this year's theme is the healing power of Jesus. Archbishop Alan Vigneron is this year's keynote speaker.
Hello, I'm Archbishop Alan Vigneron, and I want to invite all of you to the 18th Annual Lenten Symposium of the Holy Trinity Apostolate. The program is wonderful, and I look forward to being with you. My own topic is the Christian family as the agent of truth and mercy in the new evangelization. I hope to be with you there.
Other speakers include Auxiliary Bishop Francis Race, Dr. Janet Smith of Sacred Heart Major Seminary, Renewal Ministries President Ralph Martin, Fathers Peter Glass and Luigi Gabri, and Sister Sarah Marie Kuhl. The symposium is at St. Cyril Methodius on Ryan and 18 Mile in Sterling Heights. There's a youth symposium for ages 14 through 17. For ticket information, go to HolyTrinityApostolate.com and register, or call 313-277-8905. That's 313-277-8905.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Some couples do a better job of prioritizing their relationships than others, but a new study from the University of Illinois shows that all couples, even ones with a more don't-sweat-it attitude toward couple time, experience a greater risk of marital problems if they don't develop their relationship work ethic. According to the study, when people enter the workplace, they make an effort to arrive on time, be productive throughout the day, listen attentively to coworkers and supervisors, and try to get along with others. Researchers say couples should be at least as invested in their relationship work ethic, prioritizing their partner and putting the same kind of energy into active listening, planning time together, finding a workable solution for sharing household tasks, and handling personal stress so it doesn't spill over into the relationship. Our faith tells us that living our vocation as husbands and wives is the most important activity on our schedule. It seems science agrees. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
I'm back with Pastor John Berenson, a retired Lutheran pastor, a longtime friend of mine, and a regular writer for the Christian Review, and very learned person in the area of classical music, and in addition to theology and church matters. John, you know, you were saying that Paul, the Apostle Paul, himself struggles with describing this notion of on earth as it is in heaven when he talks about a spiritual body, and he talks about mortal nature having to put on an immortal body. When you're in a pastoral situation or you're in a homiletic preaching situation, isn't that really hard to explain to people?
Well, let me see. I'm just trying. The catchword there, I think, is explain. I don't, when you're in that situation pastorally, you don't explain. That you can do at the Bible class, or the Bible study, or the classroom. You have to proclaim, and proclaiming is different than explaining. And so what you do is you have to dig inside yourself and the texts and say, what is going on here? What is, literally, what is God trying to say to us as a community? And confess to the people, if it need be, as part of the homily or the sermon, that you're not going to be able to give some sort of, instruction book about the parts of heaven and the parts of the body that are mortal and immortal. That this really is a mystery. But what we do proclaim is you will indeed be reunited with your loved ones. That all those other questions we have, when we recognize one another and this and that, even in the Bible, there's a lot of things that are said that don't give us the answers. What we are, we are, there is a reunion. There is a reconciliation. Is there knowledge? Will I be walking my dog again? Even when you read N.T. Wright, he's going to let you go there and say, fine, because there's nobody even in the Bible or Thomas Aquinas or Karl Barth that can go that far with that. So I don't really worry about that. I don't try to explain it except that, it's more of a proclamation of for me, reunion. And in that sense, it's the heaven come down to earth. And also the assurance we're not just going to be singing hymns. In the Bible, those who have died are yearning and they're restless. They're not sitting there with a mantra, going om. Those who rest in the Lord are also yearning for a final consummation. And it's, I always tell people, they're really one lap ahead of us, that's all. And that's actually the way I think about it personally. My father, my father-in-law, my loved ones are not just sitting there, saying, well, okay, I'll wait for John. They're yearning the way I'm yearning, but they're just ahead of me.
By the way, the name of the book is Surprised by Hope, Rethinking Heaven, the Resurrection, and the Mission of the Church. It was published in 2008. And the quote I want to read from the book is this: to suppose that we are saved, as it were, for our own private benefit, for the restoration of our own relationship with God, and for our eventual homecoming in peace in heaven, is like a boy being given a baseball bat as a present and insisting that since it belongs to him, he must always and only play with it in private.
You're reminding me of something else that some of us Protestants have struggled with the sacraments here. I think there's a connection in our Lutheran church. About 75% of our congregations or parishes in North America have communion or the Eucharist every Sunday. However, we still have a significant percentage, 25 or so, that do it on some other basis, such as once a month or on seasons and festivals. We've been actively pursuing, at least for the last 50 years, the promotion of even our own historical roots as Lutherans, which is the weekly Lord's Supper. But anyway, one of the arguments you would hear years ago from the people who would resist this among our members is, I called it, they'd say, well, you don't bring out the fine china all the time. and if you do it too often, it's not special anymore. We call it the argument for specialness. And then I used to say to parishioners, yeah, I don't want to hug my wife or children too many times because then it would spoil things. I'm doing it a year. But again, that's working. This kind of, and I always felt that the resistance had more to do with being uncomfortable rubbing elbows with your fellow human beings and your fellow believers. and it had to do with this desire to walk in the garden alone when the dew is on the roses, as one of the old songs puts it. But this idea of passing the peace, I've had people quit churches because they thought passing the peace was going to make them sick. Well, it was always a ruse. I mean, it was a ruse. But it even comes down to petty things like this when you talk about the baton and never using it. Well, you shouldn't take communion out all the time because, you know, you don't take your china out all the time, do you? Well, I mean, that's kind of dualistic, I guess, dualistic religion.
Well, you know, but we had our problems in the Catholic Church with the past the peace, and we still do. A lot of people just that I know just cringe and do it as minimally as possible. And I think that this is an example of what N.T. Wright is talking about, that somehow the journey to salvation just doesn't involve any community or doesn't involve – you don't have to involve other people in it. It's just you and the sacraments and God.
Well, you know, the version of this, I don't remember the figure, the little literary figure of Harold Bloom. I don't even know if he's still
living. Of course, yes.
I don't know if he's still living, but
he is still living, yes.
Yeah. Very powerful back in, say, the 70s. It was called The American Religion. It wasn't one of his books on literature in that, which are very famous. But it was about religious traditions that were given birth in North American soil and what they had in common. And what was, I mean, he traced it all back to Gnosticism. He traced it all back to the desire to relate to God and eternity without any earthly intermediaries, like a community, your fellow citizens, the messiness of this earth.
Explain quickly to our listeners what Gnosticism is.
Well, Gnosticism was one of the competing and ultimately defeated, but out of a fierce battle, with the early Christian church, in terms of that there was an Old Testament God and a New Testament God. There was this earth with all of its physicality, nature, creation, rocks, trees. But all of that was just passing and unreal. So hence this is very, very Greek philosophical. And we're all going to become now, it's almost like the cults of the 20th century. You know, remember the cult that was waking for the rocket ship and in the tail of the comet. That's Gnosticism. I'm going to leave this earth, ride the comet into eternity, and so I'm going to go commit suicide.
It also suggests a kind of secretive knowledge that is known to only a few.
And it's a secret handshake. I know it and you don't know it.
Right.
But if you get on board with me and my cult. Ultimately, it was declared heresy because it meant that the incarnation of Jesus' humanity, was unreal. And things like sacraments are unreal because sacraments use...
And there's no body of the church. It's a complete denial of all materiality, all physicality.
It's a desire to relate to the spiritual without any mediation from anything earthly or historical.
And the essence of salvation in the Christian world tradition is mediation. It's all about mediation.
Right. Including for the Gnostics. I mean, so how else do we explain a manger, a cross, an empty grave, suffering?
How can you even explain prayer?
No, I was going to say, then you rule out all that. How can you relate to a God who is in a manger, who hangs on a cross, who rises from the grave? You can't. That's a different kind of God. That's Christian God.
So there is, again, this constant tension between the kinds of, you might say, cults that have come about by human reflection or human categories and human templates, and which are that the Christian tradition may have drawn on for theological concepts and theological argumentation, but which were completely transformed in the process.
Yeah.
when we talk about the Word made flesh and dwelt among us, well, the Logos, of course, was a huge concept used by Greek philosophers all the way from Heraclitus and Parmenides, you know, through Aristotle and so forth. But the very notion of the Word becoming flesh would have been a total joke to any of those Greek philosophers.
Word and flesh don't go together in
no.
the philosophical tradition.
Can't.
Word and flesh are mutually exclusive, whereas Christianity, and to a certain extent Judaism, with its view of history, makes the audacious claim not that they're fused and not that they sort of merge together, but that they coexist in a kind of eternal body.
In a person.
In a person. And that's why you say, when you come to this stuff in St. Paul about, well, what's a spiritual body look like? What is a this body? We have no exemplars, we would say in theology, except this guy called the risen Christ. That's our only analogy.
Yeah.
And then, you know.
Well, wouldn't some people say, I think, argue that there are comparisons, if not analogies, in other major religions? I mean, C.S. Lewis, at the end of his Abolition of Man, had that Tao of religion, which was mostly based upon purely ethical concepts. But in his book Miracles, for example,
yes,
he reaches for similar comparisons from other religious traditions.
This is way, way beyond me. I can speak, you know, certainly Christianity, Judaism, and a limited extent of Islam, because all of those traditions have a kind of historical, and by historical, I don't mean their history, the emphasis in their beliefs on the activity of God in human history that's not pretend, that's real. I mean, that's the limits of.
Let me answer my own question. I think the answer is yes, there are comparisons to be made, but there is no other religious tradition which makes the kind of completely, as you put it, audacious claim that the Word became flesh, period, without qualification, without any kind of spin being put on it. And that is a completely unique teaching of the Christian faith.
And the way a guy like Luther would put it, and we are big on this in our tradition, is the scandal really, and this is St. Paul, the scandal of the cross.
Yeah.
What God hangs on a tree nailed down? It completely redefines what the world means by divinity and you know, divineness. Because what the world means by divinity isn't usually about getting nailed to a tree.
Right.
And so that's the ultimate test, you know, for me. Only a crucified, as Moltmann would put it, only a crucified, we're talking about a crucified God. It's a controversial term, but I'm comfortable with it. We believe in a crucified God. And that,
by the way, was the center of von Balthasar's whole system.
His great, great book. Hans von Balthasar, who's, I guess, since 1980, he passed away or something like that. To me, and I did some work in graduate school on him, I lost track because he was so prolific, you couldn't keep up with the guy. You couldn't even buy the books fast enough.
He was like Karl Barth in that way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder if these guys had sort of, if these guys ever slept or something. even though they were, I found out they vacationed together. They vacationed together for a number of years. And
Bart and von Balthasar.
Yes, they vacationed because von Balthasar was a campus minister in Basel while Bart was in the center of his career. Bart was 10 years older. But Bart and von Balthasar would go to some seashore somewhere, and they would bring with them, Bart would bring Charlotte von Kirschbaum, his controversial lady secretary, which we don't know that much about, and von Balthasar, the convert Adrian von Speyer, who had been, what, a Protestant physician
yes.
or something like that? And then she became a mystic. Well, the four of them used to go hang out at the seashore and talk theology. I don't know what they talked about, but I know they used to hang out together. But anyway, von Balthasar, to me, his greatest book is the book on prayer, on contemplative prayer, and the other one in his book on the Paschal Mystery. It's a theology of Holy Saturday, what it means to sit on Saturday between the crucifixion and the resurrection.
His whole notion of this, of the glory of the Lord, this, you know, the beauty, was based upon the Christ form. And the Christ form itself, as you said, is a crucified, self-sacrificial form.
This is the Johannine Christ who in the Gospel of John makes the scandalous claim that his, quote, glorification, his, quote, lifting up on the cross is his great doxology. And again, that is just goes against all philosophical and literary and worldly traditions and folk traditions, that glory is to be found in being lifted up on a cross. That's what's so mind-blowing about.
Isn't this another way to approach N.T. Wright's point? You know, N.T. Wright kind of is approaching the issue from the question of what is heaven, what is an afterlife, you know, what is the resurrected life. This is approaching it from the point of view of a God who is crucified in his flesh and dies.
Right.
It's more of a, it's kind of a negative way to approach it, but it's also, you know, it's more specific, and it's also was a historical event that happened 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, and then it all gets wrapped up. You mentioned earlier the story of creation, or at least the first creation story, the one about on the first day, on the second day, dust of the earth, that kind of thing. Really, therefore, what we ultimately come to here with our discussion is it's what we preach in Christianity is not only a resurrection of the body, but new creation. New creation trumps everything. It trumps heaven and all other concepts. Everything and new creation, which is an incarnate notion, is the ultimate concept for us in terms of our hope. That we can be remade from the dust of our ashes. And, you know, that's really where I am even personally, that I am destined to become part of a new creation. I'm not being reincarnated. I'm not going to be Casper the Friendly or Unfriendly Ghost. I am destined to have this corrupt being that I am remade in a way that I can't conceive.
So is there going, I mean, when they, I guess the one sort of looming question in my mind on all this is Earth itself going to pass away in some substantial to be replaced by another kind of Earth?
When you come to the things that Wright points to and, quote, rightly points to in the book of Revelation, which frames everything, there's a talk about the first heaven and the first earth have passed away. But there is a second heaven and a second earth that is the result of their reconciliation. So there is a discontinuity.
How can there be a second heaven if heaven is heaven?
Well, now, not in, one of the things that Wright is beautiful on is there's heaven in the now, you know, where my loved ones and yours are in the conscious embrace of God. In other words, God's order of things, heaven in that sense, not heaven as a place of reward, not heaven as up in the sky, but heaven as the invisible overlapping world of God in our world. There's heaven in the now. That's, you know, that's, you know, the kingdom of heaven is in your midst. That's there in the New Testament. And then there is the heaven that comes down to earth, which is that heaven reconciled with this earth. So Wright will speak very consciously about two heavens. The first heaven, the one right now that's going on that we can't see, and that heaven reconciled and transforming the earth at the end.
The colonization.
Yeah, that's where he gets his colonization, where the values of heaven and the order of heaven, the values of the kingdom, ones of grace and mercy instead of merit and all that kind of thing, that begins to now populate the earth. That begins to fertilize the earth with a whole new set of not only values, but a whole new set of characteristics of its reality. But that's the result of heaven, you know. I'm groping here, but that's...
Well, it seems to me that, you know, what I'm thinking of is I'm not any huge fan of fantasy literature per se, Tolkien and the rest. or, you know, somewhat of C.S. Lewis's various, you know, his trilogy and his Chronicle of Narnia. But it almost takes a kind of fantasy literature approach,
yeah,
to be able to explain or imagine what this second heaven and second earth would be like.
Right, right.
Because you're really imagining an entirely new mode of existence.
Exactly. That's it. That's why you reach the limits of language. And but the prospect of it, in terms of, again, the pastoral side, our hope and hope for the world and what the world has been through is beautiful. I mean, this is, you know, just the healing quality of that, the merciful quality of that, to me, is profound. That to me is ultimately a very pastoral.
It's merciful quality in the sense of what, John?
That as bad as things have been around here, and we saw how many people get their heads cut off this morning, those Christians.
And burned to death.
As bad as this is and as bad as we are, and we're pretty darn bad, I was watching a program earlier this week, a documentary on the charisma of Hitler and how it worked, and it really spooked me. But as bad as it is down here, the victory of the grave does indeed overcome that, heal that, and reconcile that, and judge it all, because it's all together. And I think I might have said this to you once. I got a cartoon from my sister. Again, here we go with literature and what you grow for. My sister, when our children were little, and she realized my wife and I were struggling with the kids underfoot, my sister sent me a cartoon of a bedraggled mother in the middle of the living room with about five kids tearing the place apart. Her eyes were all sunken, and she had a sign that said, "The end is near, I hope." and you know, that kind of humor makes sense to me.
I think it makes sense to a lot of people, actually.
An author who was a newly discovered author to me, who was a pietist in Europe and influenced Karl Barth, was Christoph Blumhardt. The Blumhardts were pietists in Württemberg, Germany, and influenced a lot of people before the war. And there was one of the devotions I read where he said, I cannot go one single day without praying, come Lord Jesus. I mean, if you're sensitive to what this world has made of itself, how can you go through one day without praying, come Lord Jesus? You know. So this also goes to nature and grace stuff that we get involved with Catholicism and Lutheranism, nature and grace stuff. I now say in my sermons, I don't need a little help from my friends. Heck, I need to be saved.
Yeah.
I don't need a little boost. I don't need a little extra jump start. I'm lost. I'm lost. I help. You know.
It's not enough to get recharged.
No. I need to be saved because I'm, you know, something out of luck. Is it?
Real quick, in 1 minute, why did the documentary on Hitler's attractiveness spook you?
Because I realized how I could fall for it.
Wow.
The charisma, the ability with rhetoric, play upon the fears of people, their resentments, their desire to hate, the dramaturgy of it, you know, those gatherings,
yeah,
in stadiums,
yeah,
dramaturgy of it. Oh my God! I'm interested in opera and drama and this and that. I can see how when you see all those guys marching by with their goose steps, it scares me because I can see myself buying into it. Maybe.
Okay. Well, you know, I agree with you. I've had the same experience in my own contact with Hitler literature and Hitler films and Hitler documentaries. And one day we'll come back and talk about it on Church and Culture. John Berenson, retired Lutheran pastor, columnist for the Christian Review, thanks for being my guest once again on Church and Culture.
Thank you, Deal.
Talk to you next time. And all of you who are listening, please join us on this day at this time next week for two more very interesting guests.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Are you tired of the way your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. For the same reason you listen to Ave Maria, get the Michigan Catholic for just $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
Republicans, Democrats, no matter which political party is in office, there are always investment opportunities to be found. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds won't compromise the moral beliefs of its investors. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. The portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and moral values. Call toll-free 866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com.
Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc., a registered investment advisor established in 1980, serves as an investment advisor. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. To obtain performance through the most recent month-end and a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
I called a friend to check up on her. She'd been going through a personal crisis, and I could tell when she answered the phone she had been crying. We talked for a while, and while on the phone, I was silently praying to God that He would give me the words He knew she needed to hear. I've been reciting that prayer for months, and almost every day I would come across a biblical quote or an inspirational saying that I would text to her or email to her. She said to me on the phone that day, "Do you know those quotes you're sending me are keeping me going? You always seem to text me exactly what I needed to hear at that moment." Our faith teaches us that we all have crosses to bear in life. In Psalms it reads, "Passing through the valley of weeping, you'll find pools of blessings." And when you're in the valley, if you'll stay in faith, knowing that God has something better, He'll take those tears and turn them into pools to refresh you. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communication evangelist.
Have you had an encounter with Jesus Christ? What is an encounter with Jesus Christ? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. My guest this week on Power from the Pews is Declan O'Sullivan, and he has had such an encounter and has written a book to tell the tale. Join me this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. to hear his inspiring story on Ave Maria Radio and online at AveMariaRadio.net.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the Crusades is a highly explosive and very loaded word that comes up from time to time, and it is of special interest to the Eastern lung of the Church. But what exactly does this word crusade really mean?
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.